Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Another hurricane season come and gone, but the impacts remain. State lawmakers focusing on how to respond, especially for vulnerable and special needs residents.
We had some home health care agency or two that literally went around picking up their residents, dropping them off at the nearest shelter, and then left.
Also this week, a longstanding part of Florida's Constitution banning public funding of religious institutions could be overturned by popular vote if it appears on next year's ballot.
If the legislature approves a program that might benefit a school that is a religious school or a religious organization, that'll be challenged.
We'll also get an update on other proposals to change the state's fundamental document, including the qualifications for Florida's judges and a possible ban on greyhound racing. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. The 2017 hurricane season is officially over, but lawmakers are still debating how to pick up the pieces. Kate Payne reports on where they're focusing their efforts.
Representative Jeanette Nunez chairs the House Committee on Hurricane Response and Preparedness. The Miami Republican is especially concerned about emergency shelters, many of which are housed in public schools.
In particular, vulnerable populations, how we deal with our special needs population, I think is something that we have to take a long, hard look at. The lack of training, the lack of appropriate insight as it relates to shelter management.
To begin with, three of the state's 10 regions don't have enough shelter space. More critically, eight regions aren't adequately prepared to take on special needs residents.
So we have a deficit in our county of 580 spaces, but that's at 10 square foot per person. That's not the state standard of 20 square foot per person.
That's the head of Pinellas County Emergency Management, Sally Bishop.
Because we've been in shelter deficit for as long as we've been a county, and so in order to make room for everybody, we have to shrink the size down to fit everybody into it. So if you can imagine a 5x2 square on the floor, that's not a lot of space.
The space shortage is partly because the state's charter schools don't have to serve as shelters the way public schools do, though both use tax dollars. Representative Janet Cruz has a bill that would change that. Even so, shelters are often understaffed, says State Emergency Management Director Wesley Mall.
Oftentimes, communities voluntarily limit the capacity of shelter space to match the available staffing resources.
Kurt Browning says nursing homes and assisted living facilities overburdened some shelters and had no plan for residents after the storm. He's the Pasco County Schools Superintendent and oversaw shelters there.
We also found that we had some home health care agency or two that literally went around picking up their residents, dropping them off at the nearest shelter, and then left. And oftentimes at a non-special needs shelter.
Some of the worst tragedies took place at an assisted living facility that did not evacuate its residents. The rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills lost power and temperatures inside spiked. 14 died. Representative Jared Moskowitz pressed a state health care regulator for an explanation for the lack of oversight.
We're talking about there are all sorts of triggers and mechanisms. Is five people dying enough to be a trigger or a mechanism in which you believe a license should be revoked? Is that a good analysis?
The Hollywood Hills facility is in Senator Gary Farmer's district, and he's working on a bill that would beef up the state's review process and require facilities to have backup generators and fuel.
Where was the oversight over the general operations of this facility and more particularly their emergency plan? Anybody can have an emergency plan on paper. We as a state need to ensure that these facilities have the supplies, equipment, personnel, and wherewithal to carry out that plan.
Lawmakers are considering other issues as well, potential tax cuts for the state's hard-hit farmers, rethinking evacuation routes, ensuring gas stations have enough fuel and the power to operate. Representative Jeanette Nunez's committee will meet again December 4th. She hopes to start vetting recommendations then. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Certainly, state lawmakers have been busy in Tallahassee since mid-September. They've been meeting during what are called committee weeks in order to tee up legislation in advance of the 2018 lawmaking session that kicks off in early January. But another group that's been active as all get out is the Constitution Revision Commission. It meets every 20 years in Florida. It's been considering literally dozens of possible changes to the state's foundational document. After an intense vetting process, a handful of those proposals will make it to the popular ballot. Florida voters could be asked to reconsider a ban on public funding for religious organizations. Lynn Hatter reports the language has its roots in the late 1800s during a wave of new immigrants to the United States.
First, a quick history lesson. The so-called Blaine Amendments get their name from former U.S. House Speaker James Blaine. In 1875, he proposed an amendment to the U.S. Constitution stopping states from funding religious organizations. The amendment failed, but a majority of states have similar language in their constitutions. Florida's Blaine Amendment set up a barrier to using public dollars to directly or indirectly fund religious groups. A lower court ruling against former Governor Jeb Bush's school voucher program cited the prohibition in its decision. The Florida Supreme Court later struck down the program as well, but for different reasons. It's a decision that has stuck in the craw of school choice supporters at a time when many public school alternatives, like private school, are religious in nature or affiliated with religious groups. Fast forward to 2012, when the state's Republican-led legislature put an effort to repeal Blaine before voters. It failed. Now the Constitution Revision Commission wants to try again. Member Roberto Martinez says he's not a religious person, has no agenda, but thinks the language is unfair.
But I'm also a strong proponent of not putting disabilities or a bar based upon the status of a person because they happen to be a religious person or a religious institution. I think that the free exercise clause requires that we not place that disability on that entity based upon its status.
Furthermore, Martinez argues the amendment is unnecessary because the U.S. Constitution already has a similar prohibition in the First Amendment.
If the legislature approves a program that might benefit a school that is a religious school or a religious organization, that'll be challenged. And if it doesn't pass muster under the anti-establishment clause of the First Amendment, then it'll be stricken as unconstitutional. We're not touching that.
The prohibition on public funds to religious entities is inconsistent, says Commissioner Erica Donalds. She argues the state's voluntary pre-kindergarten program has many religious providers, and the state has partnered with faith-based groups and paid money to them, everything from hospitals to prison to adoption facilitators.
You know, we know many areas in which, as Commissioner Stemberger mentioned, the partnership between faith-based organizations and the state come together for the public good and not to promote that religion. And if this were consistently applied, if it were to be left on principle, if it were right, that none of those things would be able to take place and that our state would be less rich because of that.
But Blaine has its supporters, and the fight over whether it should stay or go is heated. Speaking on the side of keeping it is Arthenia Joyner, a Tampa Bay Democrat and former state senator.
But why should your freedom become my burden? Should the taxpayers of Florida be compelled to pay for your choice? Should the taxpayers be forced to send their money to a religious group preferred by someone else? Because that's what this amendment, this proposal would do.
And Winter Garden resident Joseph Richardson drove 4 hours to attend the meeting just to speak against repealing Blaine.
The coercive taxing power of the government should not be wielded to oblige Muslims to bankroll temples and yeshivas or to compel Jews to subsidize Christian churches and Catholic schools or to force Christians to fund mosques and madrasas. And as a non-believer, I should not be forced to fund any of the above.
But Commissioner John Stemberger, who heads the conservative Florida Family Policy Council, argues faith is a public good, and the work religious-based organizations do contributes to society in ways that governments can't. In Florida, amendment proposals must be approved by 60% of Florida voters in order to be added to the state constitution. And in 2012, the repeal effort failed with less than 50% support. But Martinez, the amendment sponsor, says times are changing, and he thinks it's about time to give an effort to repeal Blaine another go. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, more from the Constitution Revision Commission. Floridians could soon vote on how much experience a person must have before becoming a judge.
It has uniformly been well received and supported, and that was the genesis of my proposal to raise that eligibility experience requirement to 10 years.
A former and current lawmaker teaming up to add a ban on dog racing to the state constitution.
There is broad consensus in the legislature that what's going on now with greyhounds is absolutely terrible. But there is not a consensus that we can get anything done.
And we'll talk with the writer of a new book about what to do before and after storm floods strike.
I've hit a lot of topics. I had a lot of help. And I'm very grateful for that. And it will help people. That's a fact.
A proposal changing the eligibility requirements for becoming a judge in a state or county court is starting to move in a committee of the Constitution Revision Commission. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's the panel that meets every 20 years to revise the state constitution and put the matter before voters.
Under current state law, Florida Supreme Court justices and District Court of Appeal judges must be members of the Florida Bar for 10 years, but for circuit and county court judges, CRC Commission member Bill Schifino says they don't have the same requirements.
The Constitution requires that a person must have been a member of the Florida Bar for only the preceding 5 years to be eligible for the office of circuit judge. The same five-year requirement presently applies to county court judges, unless the county has a population of 40,000 or less. The legislature has not amended the constitutional membership requirement for candidates filling a county court judgeship in a county with a population of 40,000 or less.
So Schifino has a proposal creating a uniform eligibility standard for all those seeking a judicial post, 10 years as a practicing lawyer in Florida.
You know, I've been practicing 30 years, and in my term as president and president-elect of the Florida Bar, and speaking with many judges, speaking with many members of the Florida Bar, the uniform consensus is that it is time to raise that Florida Bar membership requirement from 5 to 10 years. I think it speaks for itself. Experience matters, life experiences, and I think all in all that it will make for an even more attractive judiciary. So,
Schifino's proposal came up for its first vote in the Florida Constitution Revision Commission's Judicial Committee, a panel he chairs. But fellow commissioner and state senator Tom Lee questioned Schifino about who this would apply to.
So as a practical matter, if you've been a practicing lawyer for 20 years but only lived in Florida for 7, you wouldn't be able to run for judge?
That would be correct.
And Attorney General Pam Bondi, also a CRC commissioner, says that could rule out some good people.
You know, Commissioner Schifino, I was going to wholeheartedly agree with you. I just thought you had to be a member of a bar for 10 years. But because I agree, I don't think a five-year lawyer is ready to be a judge. I just don't. But I think Commissioner Lee's point, I don't know if you'd be willing to amend it. I mean, what if you do have someone who's practiced for 20 years and then comes to Florida and has practiced for 6 years, 7 years, they wouldn't be qualified to be a judge?
And while he says that was unintentional, Schifino says he's willing to amend his proposal to allow for lawyers from any other state's bar to apply to be a judge as long as they have 10 years experience. He intends to amend it at its next stop, the CRC's Executive Committee. After that, the full 37-member Constitution Revision Commission will take up the proposal. If approved, they'll place it on the 2018 ballot. It will then require 60% of voter approval to be part of the state's constitution. Meanwhile, Schifino's measure increasing the mandatory retirement age for Florida judges from 70 to 75 also passed the CRC's Judicial Committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
While animal rights activists argue greyhound racing has no place in Florida today, Regan McCarthy reports others argue a ban on the practice has no place in the state constitution.
Just 18 dog tracks are still holding races in the United States. About a dozen of those are in Florida, but officials say even fewer are lucrative.
According to filings with the State Department of Business and Professional Regulation, Florida dog tracks are collectively losing just over $31 million on greyhound racing each year.
Carrie Teal works with the animal rights organization Grey 2K. He says Florida dog tracks keep their dogs running because it's required in order for them to continue offering other kinds of gambling, like poker. But he says that rule is not only hurting the businesses, it's hurting the dogs.
On average, a greyhound dies every 3 days at a Florida dog track. According to the official state records, 94% of the dogs that died were 3 years old or younger. Many of the death reports do not indicate why the dog died. It just says, dog died on this date, and there's no further data. But we have looked very closely at the death reports, and we were able to directly attribute 60% of them, roughly, to race incidents. Dog suffered a broken neck, dog didn't finish a race, and then dies later that day.
Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee says that's an example of why greyhound racing no longer makes sense in Florida.
As we've evolved, we've banned all sorts of activities that have been considered cruel to animals, bullfighting and cockfighting and all kinds of things. And to me, this is just the next step on that plane of becoming more sensitive to this kind of inhumanity.
Lee, who is also a member of the Constitution Revision Commission, is proposing an amendment that would phase out greyhound racing. Lawmakers have discussed plans for years to reduce greyhound racing, from all-out bans to decoupling or allowing paramutuals to continue offering games like poker without requiring them to hold races. But Don Gates, a former Florida Senate president and current member of the CRC, says the proposals seem to get bogged down.
There is broad consensus in the legislature that what's going on now with greyhounds is absolutely terrible. But there is not a consensus that we can get anything done, not because of a lack of understanding of the issue or a sympathy to the issue or a defense of greyhound racing, but simply because the nature of the legislative process is we open a chapter of law and then we attract and invite amendments that become destructive to the purpose of the legislation and bring us to places dealing with issues that the legislature can't or won't deal with in terms of the expansion of gaming.
Gates says he believes changes to the state's constitution should be made when there is no other way to address an issue. And he says greyhound racing meets that standard. Lee agrees a constitutional change makes sense.
The legislature has been grappling with this since I returned to the legislature in 2013. And, of course, this commission is one of its great promises is that it is less encumbered by some of the influences and less compromised by some of the influences that the legislature has to be attendant to. And it is my hope that what is bogged down in the legislature and they've been unable to achieve, we can accomplish through this Constitutional Revision Commission.
No members of the greyhound racing industry spoke during the CRC General Provisions Committee meeting, but they have attended many legislative discussions on the topic in the past and have stressed their fondness for the dogs under their care. The proposal gained approval from its first committee. It will need to get approval from one more committee and the full CRC in order to be added to the ballot for a referendum vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Just over 8% of Americans who have vision trouble do not have vision insurance, and half of those who have the option to buy vision insurance don't. From Health News Florida, Daylena Miller talked to some Tampa Bay area residents who wear eyeglasses and think vision insurance isn't worth the cost.
Musician Dave Eichenberger is on his computer at his Newport Richey studio. He's uploading a headshot to an online optical store so he can virtually try on a pair of fuchsia-tinted eyeglasses.
Oh, I'm sideways, but we can fix that. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to rotate my head sort of like that. And then we have to scale this. Oh, okay.
Americans spend more than $15 billion each year on eyewear. Eichenberger feels a lot of that is expensive eyeglasses and insurance premiums that aren't worth paying.
What I found was that it is really not serving a lot of people out there. It certainly didn't serve me.
Vision and dental are not part of most healthcare plans, so people have the option not to purchase them. Eichenberger pays for a supplemental dental plan, but doesn't have a vision option, and he knows he couldn't afford it.
Money that I would have to spend on vision insurance so far exceeded what I just spent out of my pocket on glasses on an exam.
So he found a local optometrist willing to do the exam for $50 and purchases his progressive bifocals online, spending less than $200 altogether. Those one-stop shops you see in malls and shopping centers, like LensCrafters or VisionWorks, rarely offer the new discounts popping up online and at some retailers. Marina Berry is a young tattoo artist in Tampa. She has astigmatism, an imperfection that 1 in 3 Americans have, and it can make eyeglasses really expensive.
Pay out of pocket, it's around $50 for an eye exam, but it's like the lenses that'll be the issue, is actually getting them made for you, especially if you have like such a special condition as I do.
She got her exam done at Optical Outlets, one of the stores that's offering special exam and eyeglass bundles. She says her astigmatism still pushed the price up past the advertised $90 to $250. She says that's still a lot less than paying monthly premiums and all the special upgrades insurance typically doesn't cover.
It just doesn't really seem worth it to get the insurance. There's Optical Outlets everywhere. There's Walmarts everywhere.
Kyle Barnett is a district manager in Florida for America's Best, another discount retailer. He touts his company's $69.95 special, which includes an eye exam and 2 pairs of glasses. While the pricing changes depending on a patient's needs, he says they're transparent about every fee.
We definitely want to reach out to those that don't have the managed care piece or the vision insurance, and also for those that are looking for just a great deal.
Barnett says one of the biggest advantages to their deals is that, like vision insurance, it encourages people to come back for regular checkups.
People are more prone to come back in, and really increasing the frequency of the eye exams in our local area and to help fight all those ocular diseases by finding them early.
Musician Dave Eichenberger knows it's dangerous to wait too long between exams. He's diabetic and has a higher risk of eye damage called retinopathy.
By the time you notice vision problems, things have gone horribly wrong already. So you don't want it to get to that. So you want to go to the eye doctor all the time.
He says because he's not limited by insurance requirements and monthly premiums, he can afford to go at least once a year. I'm Daylena Miller in Tampa.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the final day of the 2017 Atlantic hurricane season was on Thursday of this week. Now there's a new book out by a former federal disaster inspector that might be a good addition to the preparations Florida residents make for next year's storm season. Julie Beller has seen some of the worst that Mother Nature can dish out when it comes to storm-connected flooding events.
I started with Hurricane Katrina. And as a FEMA inspector, I wanted to make a difference, and I had a lot of compassion for those people and everything that happened to them. And I constantly heard people say to me while inspecting, if I only knew then what I know now, I would have done it differently.
After Katrina, Beller left FEMA and got her insurance adjuster's license in the state of Texas, giving her the authority to do that work in 30 states nationwide. In the aftermath of Hurricane Ike in 2008, Beller was doing windstorm adjusting in a small coastal Texas town.
During that time, I met a couple named Tony and Jody. And Tony and Jody are the first people I talk about in the first chapter of how they went from $2,000 to $42,000 on their flood insurance claim.
Something they were able to do, says Beller, first because the settlement was legally available to them.
The National Flood Insurance Program wants to pay you. It's not like some insurance companies that try to cut you off.
The problem, says Beller, is that in the wake of disasters, the feds have to hire temporary adjusters who may not be fully aware of how flood damages are calculated.
I really think it's important, and I think it's important we educate people that think that they're paying a premium and that they should know that when that person comes out to do their adjusting of their property on that damage, that they might not know how to read an elevation certificate, and that can definitely impact your claim and how much you'll receive.
That's why Beller wrote her book, Show Me the Flood Money. In it, she talks about such things as elevation certificates, how to file flood damage claims, and deal with adjusters and the Federal Flood Insurance Program. There's also lots of information when it comes to rebuilding after the flood.
I talk about contractors and how to pick a contractor because a lot of them come from out of state when it's a big, big disaster. And how are you, one, supposed to know if they do quality work? And I go into detail of how they can do research and what websites you can check. And one of the contractors' background information that one can check is through contractorcheck.com. It's affiliated with Experian. Or there's another one, contractors-license.org. Or for us Florida residents, there's always the Disaster Contractors Network portal.
Other topics include how to prepare before the disaster strikes and accessing an entire range of public and private emergency response services. Beller says it's as comprehensive a work as she could produce while still making it a concise, easy-to-understand handbook.
I'm partial. A lot of time went into it over 9 years, but I've hit a lot of topics. I had a lot of help, and I'm very grateful for that, and it will help people. That's a fact.
Because there's another fact Beller worries about, that flooding events will only get more intense and numerous as time goes on, simply based on her experience.
This isn't my specialty at all when it comes to environment and climate change. And yes, I use the word climate change and sea rise, but I believe so. In my personal opinion, yes.
Show Me the Flood Money by former FEMA inspector, now Tallahassee-based independent expert flood consultant, Julie Beller. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.